Welcome to Conversations on Coast Access Radio. In this program, we have conversations with people about their interests, their lives, the things that motivate and excite them.
Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of Conversations. I have the great pleasure to have a recent resident to the Kapiti Coast in my studio today, Kyriakos Kallis Zozi, who you also may know as Charles Kallis, and goes by the pet name of Koz. Hey, Koz.
Hello.
Welcome to the studio. Now, we are going to be doing a couple of interviews with Koz. The first one, we are going to focus on his upbringing and his involvement with the Olympic Museum. Koz, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, mid-50s, I was born in Wellington into an extraordinarily vibrant, closed environment of the Greek Cypriot community.
Okay, so the Greek Cypriot community comes from the island of Cyprus.
Correct.
So, and they are kind of a little separate from Greece as a whole.
Yeah, they are a standalone republic with very long historical associations, particularly in terms of language.
Okay.
And in terms of religion, Greek Orthodoxy. My mother came from a tiny island on the western seaboard of Greece called Kastos, 4 miles long, 1 mile wide.
So everybody knew everybody and then some.
Well, the thing is, a little bit more than that, they're probably all inbred, to be honest. Three major families. It's the most beautiful little island. And I've always said there are probably more residents of the island in Miramar than on the island itself.
In terms of descendants, I think, I assume you're talking about?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the moment, there's only about 40 permanent residents on the island.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's very special.
So that's where Mum was born. And what about Dad?
Yeah, Dad was born in Cyprus. He arrived in 1945 to Wellington. He was escorting his sister at the end of the Second World War on a Red Cross ship. His sister was bringing over her daughter. And Dad had to travel as her son, as an escort. And his father said to him, go and escort your sister to this faraway land called New Zealand. And my father, I remember saying so many times, where is this land? And he said, when I get there, I will stay for 2 weeks. Then I'm coming back home.
He had no interest in actually immigrating.
Absolutely zero. He was going through a shoemaking apprenticeship in his tiny village, central Cyprus. What I can say is that 22 years later, he took me, my sister and mum back to Cyprus.
Right.
22 years. That's how long it took him to go home.
Wow. And so were your grandparents still alive?
Yes. My father's parents were, and it was just the most joyful meeting of them. I recall my grandmother, you know, her embrace was just so beautiful. My grandfather was a little bit of a tougher sort, but the emotion was there. And honestly, the village they live in, Palihori it's called, the old village, Palihori, the old village, honestly, it was really like going back, you know, 300 years.
Right.
Mum's island was similar. Kastos, we went there. Her parents were long gone, long past, and we were going back in time 300 years.
Right. That was your history or where you came from. But you were born in New Zealand, but still grew up in that Greek Cypriot environment.
Oh, yes. Total immersion.
So that was Miramar mostly?
Yes. Lyle Bay, Miramar. No, Strathmore. Strathmore for me. But it was a world of where you spoke only Greek until the age of 5.
Wow.
No kindergarten. Mother and father didn't basically trust the education system. So I arrived at Lyle Bay School at the age of 5, not speaking English.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was a real challenge. My sister, 5 years older, was there, and I just recall the teacher in despair, the words were, send for Stella. And she would arrive saying, what's wrong this time in Greek? And I just would cry and say, I want to go home.
Yeah, fair enough too. And so was there a feeling of, like, as an adult looking back, that Mum and Dad's feelings around that kind of held you up a little bit or made it more difficult for you to assimilate?
Well, they were passionate about a Greek Hellenic upbringing. We even went to Greek school. After school, from primary school, you get on the bus from Seton and all the way into town and have a Greek school experience for 2 to 3 hours, absolute exhaustion. Then you get on the bus back home. And by the time you got home, you were completely exhausted.
And how was that, 5 days a week?
No, 3 days a week.
Wow.
And we would
from the age of five?
More like 7, 8. We'd go to Greek school. But, you know, and at the time I was just so frustrated. I want to be playing with my friends, etc. But look, in hindsight, to have actually been brought up with Greek as the primary language, which in later life came to be one of the great advantages of my life in terms of a particular job that I secured.
Right. So growing up, a mixed education, 5 days a week at a traditional New Zealand school, and then 3 days, 3 afternoons a week getting the education at a Greek school. Is that still around now?
Yes, there is still a Greek school system. In those days, the Greek church would organise to bring out a teacher from Greece. And so she, in the case of a she, as it came, the male or females over the years. So we had both the Greek priest of the day and a Greek teacher of the day. So, you know, you went from one teaching environment, you know, the New Zealand system, to another teaching environment where you had to memorize play after play or poem after poem, and the discipline was very different,
right.
A little bit more physical than the New Zealand environment, you know.
Even in the 50s?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was, a slap on the backside and a clip around the ears by the Greek school system. So it was a very strange environment to go from one world to another.
And so it was just yourself and your sister?
Yeah.
So a smaller than normal family?
Yes. So smaller than normal family, that's right.
So in terms of your social, so outside of school, did you mainly only mix with other Greek Cypriots?
Yes, that's probably fair enough that my main friends were relatives, basically, cousins, relatives, because we were a very close-knit community. Yep. And we had connections in Whanganui, we had connections in New Plymouth, we had Cypriot connections in the Christchurch. But Wellington was the hub, really, of networks of friends. And it wasn't until going to college that one started to interact with non-Greeks in particular. And to this day, I've got two very dear friends I met in Form 1 who both live in Kapiti.
Oh, okay, brilliant. So what high school did you end up going to?
Rongotai College.
Okay. And so went through college, and at what point did you start making decisions about what you wanted to do?
Well, where do I start? The Greek system was very prescribed, even to the point of arranged marriages. And going to university was liberating. It was an eye-opener. And, you know, you fell in love straight away. I mean, what chance did you have? You know, meanwhile.
And what decade was this? This was the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, free love. And,
yeah, exactly. New Zealand was kind of finding its feet, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, save the whales and hug the trees. You know, we're right into that. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, there's an arranged marriage underway, which I, although she was a really lovely woman, I rejected. I rejected that because no one was going to tell me who I was going to marry. And for years, and that caused a heck of a storm, I can tell you.
I can imagine.
Yeah. But I can tell you that as a career, I had learnt that when asked at social functions, now what are you going to be when you grow up? Well, it was no good saying that you wanted to be a school teacher or a male nurse, you know, two wonderful professions, and I did become a teacher. It became easier to say something like, I want to be a civil engineer. Oh, that's great. That's great. Not quite the brain surgeon. Not quite the lawyer, but it will do. And then, that became almost like a fait accompli that I, right to seventh form, I trained, took classes on the basis of becoming a civil engineer.
Right.
Got to uni, and then I said, there's no way I'm doing this. And I changed my whole subject and my whole life to a sociology and education degree.
Right.
And went on to become a teacher and taught up here 43 years ago. I'm an old boy up here.
At Paraparaumu School?
I did. Not for long, but yeah. I was here.
Excellent.
I was here and living in Raumati.
So that environment, even 43 years ago, so that's the 1980s. Jeez, I can work that out.
Yeah, well done.
I was good at maths, I was. So the 1980s, Kapiti was still quite a closed environment.
Yeah. Yeah,
really?
Yeah. It's. I think its demographic was very Anglo-Saxon and Maori, of course. You know, but it's not the vibrant community that Kapiti is trending towards now.
So you went to Rongotai College, then on to Victoria University, got your BA in Education and Sociology, started teaching. Oh, so went to Wellington Teachers Training, and taught at both primary and secondary level.
Yes, teaching degree, which was a postgraduate degree, enabled me to migrate between primary or secondary.
And did you have a preference?
I had really enjoyed Form 1 and 2. I really did enjoy it. I enjoyed that opportunity to inspire young New Zealanders. I guess a mistake one can make is going back to your old secondary school because, you know, you meet the teachers that you thought were old at the time, and when you ask after them, you know, sometimes the outcome of who they are and who they really were and where they ended up isn't quite what I anticipated.
Right. Yeah, so that can be a bit hard. But you hadn't finished with study at that stage.
No. Well, in the sense, the study came later in terms of a master's degree.
Yep.
That occurred once I became immersed in the Olympic world.
Okay. So, but before that, so you taught. I also see you were a fish wholesaler. How do you fit that in with?
Well, it's in the blood.
You know,
I also owned a fish and chip shop for a while. So, you know,
Are you doing the stereotypical thing there, Coz?
Yeah, if you strip the DNA of a Greek, you're going to find F&C, fish and chips. And then I had to do it. It was a terribly difficult job with my former brother-in-law. And one of the hardest aspects of the job was actually getting the raw materials, supply of fish.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not an easy process in those days. It was a wild west. About a year and a half I stayed in that job, and then I gravitated to become a fish wholesaler for a man who actually owned and operated the Waikanae Fish Supply.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. This is a guy called George Stavronos, who, to his credit, became an incredibly wealthy and well-connected man in the fishing industry in New Zealand. From Waikanae, he purchased a vibrant fish supply in Wellington called Port Nicholson Fisheries, and he could only speak very limited English, and he needed someone to do his accounts and someone to do his office work and apply for licenses, and guess who? It was me.
Right.
It was a tough job. It was a very difficult job, incredibly rewarding, but it was one of those jobs, 8,000 hours a week.
Right.
You know, you had to just work and work. And I had a young son who I never saw.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought, right, that's it. And from there, I navigated to the profession that really I found satisfied me, and I was in the right direction in terms of museums.
Okay. At this stage, so we've done the fish thing and we've done the teaching thing, teaching of the small children thing.
Yeah.
1990, you began working at the Petone Settlers Museum.
Yeah, I did. I was given an opportunity there. And being a small museum, you do have the opportunity of doing everything.
Right.
From sweeping the floor to eventually becoming part-time director of the museum. So that was a real joy, and there I was able – it satisfied my storytelling desire,
right.
It satisfied curatorial desire, it satisfied collection management desire, and I worked with a very inspirational director of the day, David Mealing. But it was a fascinating environment because, yes, it was an early settler museum, but for me what was exciting, it was at the advent of touchscreen interactive technology.
Oh, okay.
In 1990.
Yep.
I thought the – IBM had just introduced that technology,
mm-hmm.
which is so common today. But then it was just a new innovation. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to create an interactive system that, with all the immigration records of arrivals to Te Whanganui Atara, Wellington Harbour, of early settlers in 1840 onwards, wouldn't it be great if someone could come into the museum and actually navigate using a touchscreen system, type in the surname Cameron or Davidson or whatever, and be able to find historical archival data that included records from the vessel they came on, whether it included a photo of the ship they came on, and also we're gathering family history, a photo of the individuals. So that was, with the support of IBM New Zealand, a groundbreaking exercise.
Excellent. That's quite a shift from teaching and fish wholesaling to being part of a new interactive system.
Correct. But I guess I had a passion for science, I still do. I was brought up in this, this Hellenic world that I was brought up in, which is powerful in storytelling. My mother could not write her own language, and she couldn't read her own language. But she was immensely articulate and could paint these wonderful pictures of stories of, you know, back on the island, the Second World War, the Italians invading. They ate our donkey, she said at one stage, you know. In me, it's sort of a notion of creating storytelling opportunities.
Right.
And for me, the vision was with this touchscreen system, I envisaged a grandmother coming in with a grandson or granddaughter, and that she, the grandmother, takes command of the system. And that's exactly what happened. They'd come in and they'd press into an old-style typewriter. Some of your listeners may have been there at the time at the Petone Museum. And that, to me, was a very wonderful outcome.
Yeah. And because for a lot of certain generations, technology can be scary.
Totally.
And the fact that it was one that they could actually control.
Yeah.
And then tell their history to their grandchildren.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Well, I'm very proud of that because, you know, at the moment we've got all, everything's to do with AI, of course. AI this and AI that. Well, you know, at the end of the day, AI should be enabling individuals, particularly the elderly, to navigate systems without fear.
Yes.
And I was delighted to be able to produce a system that was publicised worldwide, actually.
Wow.
Mm.
You've got some big history behind you there, Coz. All right, that was the most of the 90s. And then in 1999, you became director of the New Zealand Olympic Museum. Now, obviously, the birthplace of the Olympics is Greece.
You think of Olympia in Greece as the historic home of the Olympic movement.
Yeah.
For me, it was one of the probably the most symbolic, significant jobs of my life. To the New Zealand Olympic Museum, which was in its infancy when I gained the job, enabled me over 16 years to shape it, to celebrate through exhibitions and displays the power of the Olympic movement through the stories, particularly of New Zealand Olympians. The Sir Murray Halbergs, the Peter Snells, the Yvette Williams, etc. It goes on and on. The Olympic movement is driven very powerfully by an Olympic charter, and it's the handbook of how every Olympic committee in the world must operate or needs to operate. But the Olympism or the Olympic value set is a powerful set of drivers, words like friendship and excellence, fair play, not words that the public generally hear because we're caught up in the spectacle of games.
Yeah.
But the Olympic movement can be summarized as an educational movement for youth.
Oh, okay.
Which I immediately resonated with me.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and it's where sport is an enabler to influence and change young people's lives, particularly through the role modelling with Olympians. Often I would say to Olympians who had competed at a particular Games, you realise your work starts now because you are the role model that these young sports people will admire and aspire to. And that was something that was very unique. And in the world, it was unique because the way we ran the Olympic Museum, which was internally within the organisation, unlike other Olympic committees, which abdicated their responsibility of the Olympic Museum by farming out to Sports Hall of Fame. We were running our internal museum, the aim being to influence the entire ethos of the organisation. So we were regarded at the highest level by the International Olympic Committee.
Wow.
So I was very proud of that time.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
So the Olympic Museum was run by the New Zealand Olympic Committee.
Right.
I reported to them.
Yeah.
So that gave us enormous insights into the management of the Olympic movement in Switzerland, the parent organisation, and all Olympic committees around the world. Yep. So you had access to them as well. So the Paralympics would benefit and also contribute to the welfare of sport. And we would, for example, I went to the Athens Olympic Games as an administrator. And when we left those games, we left resources behind for the Paralympic team. So, yeah, so it was an extraordinary time in my life. We also managed the Commonwealth Games, the New Zealand Olympic Committee. All that deep, rich history, to be in the presence of Olympians is an extraordinary experience. They are unique individuals. They are almost, they have an aura around them. They have pushed their bodies and their minds. And I was really privileged to meet some outstanding New Zealanders. The one thing we did introduce, which I thought was very powerful, well, we know was powerful, we introduced an Olympic numbering system for Olympians.
Okay. But like they do with like the rugby, the All Blacks number, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot of misunderstanding about who was and who was not an Olympian. In fact, the International Olympic Committee prescribes who is an Olympian. Basically, those that take the field of play.
Yeah.
But to get them into a number sequence was special. We had gold pins that they each received. And that really gave them, the Olympians who had not medaled, a sense of ownership.
Right.
Because though what I discovered was that you had Olympians who competed, didn't place, or got third place, or second place, but felt that they'd let their country down. But by numbering them and welcoming them back into the system was hugely empowering.
Well, I think the big thing about that, just from an outsider's point of view, because never had any dreams of being in the Olympics, is all the work they've gone into to actually get to that level where they qualify to represent our country.
Good Lord, the effort involved.
Exactly.
I mean, we were striking Olympians of whom their family knew nothing about their Olympic participation because they participated as young people. But one thing I like to comment about is in 2004, the Athens Olympics was a really extraordinary, brilliant time because it was a time when the Olympic movement chose to embark on a very powerful relationship with Māoridom in terms of coming alongside Māoridom and saying, what elements can the power of your communities, your power of your traditions, add to sporting outcomes? I was privileged to have worked with a wonderful Māori gentleman from the East Coast, North Island, Amster Reedy. And through Amster and others, Trevor Shaler, for example, what was introduced was the kākahu or Māori cloak that only the flag bearer could wear. We were taught haka as team members, the value of haka, the power of haka, the true meaning. And we introduced ponamu as a gift that would be put over the neck of every incoming official of the Games, athlete or official. So this extraordinary power that we had over other Olympic teams, and we celebrated that, and it was just a very, very significant time, 2004 Games.
Wow.
Which
so
went to my homeland, of course.
Yes, exactly, and that's nearly 20 years.
Yeah, exactly, but it resonates with me. I mean, it was a powerful time. We made a documentary at the time. I helped to contribute to that, and it was made by a good mate of mine, Gordon Irving, that went internationally and won awards. The International Olympic Committee gave us permission to film behind the scenes in the Olympic Village, which is normally a no-go zone for media.
Do you know, I feel like I've seen that 2004.
One team, one spirit.
I was a mother of a one-year-old.
Yeah.
So the actual memory banks are probably not that strong.
Mm.
But yes, the 2004, and for a lot of people, I think once we slipped over into the century, much more coverage, much more ability for people to be able to follow these games than there had been in the past. It was radio or the paper the next day or whatever, and now we were able to actually follow and view and almost be part of it.
Absolutely, to immerse yourself in it and be a participant.
So that took us through to 2015, and I'm just roughly working out that you must have been heading towards that magic 65. Around about then, in terms of age. I was wondering why you stepped away from the New Zealand Olympic Museum.
Sorry. In about 2013, the New Zealand Olympic Committee made a strategic decision that after about a century of being in Wellington, to totally relocate to Auckland, all lock, stock and barrel. And I was living in Waikanae at the time. I made a decision not to go to Auckland.
Yep.
I had established a digital online Olympic museum. And their discussion with me was, look, we're moving into a historic building in Remuera that has no exhibition space, but do come up. It would have meant everything would have been digital. Everything, you know, this beautiful collection we'd accumulated. I just made a strategic decision. And they said, if you're not coming, then we will dismantle the museum. So I had this somewhat agonizing and exhausting task of dismantling 16 years of work, but was extremely careful to ensure that the collection entered the correct repositories around New Zealand, like National Archives, like the Turnbull Library, Canterbury Museum, Auckland Museum.
Right.
So rather than the collection being lost, and we're talking about shift emission reports. We're talking about the New Zealand Olympic Committee's minutes. You know, Jack Lovelock writing letters back to New Zealand and shift emissions reports over time about their impressions of each game they led. So it was an exhausting time, but that's why the museum ceased to operate. And to this day, do I regret it? Well, I do in part. But at the same time, that was the decision of the day.
And also, too, you did what you needed and wanted to do, and you made sure all that material was kept safe and can be seen by people at different
locations.
Absolutely,
absolutely. Yeah.
So currently, what are you currently?
Well, if I could just go back a little bit. From Mike and I moved to the top of the South Island, living in the Motueka, Tasman area.
Yep.
On a wonderful friend's farm, great friend of mine that I met in Eastbourne 43 years ago. On that farm, I built three tiny homes. But I always kept an interest in offering museum, curatorial or collection management work. So about nearly close to 3 years ago, I moved to Kapiti from down south for various reasons. To this day, I am still involved in collection management work. As an example, I am offering strategic advice to the Bruce McLaren Trust, whose collection is based in Hampton Down, north of Hamilton. So Bruce McLaren, of course, only younger listeners will struggle to know who Bruce McLaren we're talking about, and that's the motor racing legend.
Some of them may have seen the movie.
Yes, some may have. But it is interesting the number of people I encounter who do not correlate Formula One McLaren with a man, the New Zealander.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely widespread. So what the aspiration is, having spent over a year now advising on the management of the collection, which is an extraordinary collection, beautiful collection, which I'd like to talk about briefly, but the aspiration is that in Remuera, Bruce's father in the 1950s and earlier owned a petrol station, which has now been purchased by an individual. And the aim is, the aspiration is to convert it into a centre for Bruce McLaren. Not a museum, a centre of aspiration. I say that because Bruce was a man who, to know Bruce, although he died young in 1970, is to understand a man who inspired others. And even just dealing with his collection is phenomenal. He was passionate about writing letters home to his father, telling them all about his great successes in Europe. He would send audio tapes home. People also won't know that Bruce spent 2 years of his life and strapped to a steel bed because he had a problem with one of his hips. And he, in those 2 years, he aspired to be a motor racing champion. And he lived his dream, a constructor, a driver. And on his death, there was a really interesting moment, fascinating moment when, sadly, you know, the news was revealed to the men that were building the cars for him, and the management said, look, we've lost Bruce, go home, and really it's up to you whether you come back again. Well, that very next day they were back. And that's in the documentary.
Yeah.
They came back and did not stop because they said that's what Bruce wanted us to do. So with a wonderful collection, that's part of the work that I do part-time now. But otherwise I'm get involved with community-based activities and although I'm not a member of Rotary, Kapiti Rotary, which is a wonderful group of people, wonderful, I love helping out in projects when possible. And I just think, you know, what I've found with Kapiti is just that it's this extraordinary body of volunteerism. People just want to support and help.
Yeah, we find that here as well because, you know, being a community radio station, that we have 4 paid staff and all the rest of the people who work for us are volunteers because that's how it operates.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to call it there on the conversations, but we will be coming back and chatting to you again at a further stage for another aspect of your life that we need to share to people. But that is going to be part of a different program series. So I have been chatting to Charles Kallis, or
Kyriakos Kallis Zorzi,
also known as Koz, a fabulous man from the Kapiti Coast, and we have been talking about his amazing work life in various industries, finishing up with his connection with New Zealand Olympic Museum. You've been listening to Conversations, and I've been your host, Nikki Carroll.
You've been listening to Conversations on Coast Access Radio, a program where we talk with people about their lives, their passions, their interests.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.